Hey, everybody. Before we start this episode, we just want to make a couple of clarifying remarks about our fact discussion at the end of episode 5. There are more than a couple of people who have pointed out that the way we said certain things may have sounded a bit disparaging towards newer players, and that's really not what we meant at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes easy to lose track of the fact that this is a game that's really brought a lot of casual players to the game. And I think, especially since we've played so much, especially against each other, it's easy to say, oh, well, we've got it figured out, so why doesn't everyone else? And that's just completely wrongheaded of us.
Absolutely. I think if we intended to get across any kind of frustration, it's not with people who are newer to the game. Certainly, this is brought over people who are fans of CCGs and LCGs, but also people who are more on the board gaming side because of things like Quarriors. But despite all of that, I think what we really wanted to get across was more of our frustration with the fact that the fact did very little to settle some of the most contentious rules debates that were out there. It's not about the validity of, you know, what they chose to answer, because certainly if they thought it was a frequently asked question, then people were asking it. But a lot of the big rules debates out there weren't settled by it, and that was our problem. And we're very, very sorry that, especially me, I think I was probably the worst one at this. I'm very, very sorry. I did not mean to come off that way at all. That's not what I intended. And guys, I apologize.
Yeah, I think I kind of played off with you the most. I think Evan gets to be in the clear a little bit on this one, but I'm also very, sorry if it came off that way, because it did to at least a couple of people.
And I'll point out that all of us still have a lot of things we're unclear on in the facts, so even if we're veterans of various LCGs and CCGs and whatever TLAs you want to put together, we still frequently don't know, so there's nothing wrong in not knowing.
Absolutely. We have a running Skype chat that we just kind of all contribute to at random times, and there'll be times when one or another of us says, hey, how would this interaction work? And then we argue about it for a little while. So, Evan, completely right. Plus, you also get to probably make fun of us a bit because you were the most conciliatory out of all.
I'll take the moral high ground here and not do so.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks, guys, for bearing with us with that. Totally not what we meant. And again, we're really sorry. Let's take it in and get started with another episode of The Reserve Pool.
The Reserve Pool, Episode 6, Demolishing the Super Rares.
Folks, welcome back to another episode of The Reserve Pool, a podcast about Dice Masters and the people who love to play it. I am Dave.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Evan.
All right. Evan, was that supposed to be me right there?
Wait, what?
I don't know. And I'm Evan. It sounded like my host voice for a moment, and I think you might have been making fun of me.
No, that was me just trying to be a little more enthusiastic than my normal Eeyore voice allows.
That's okay. You're allowed to make fun of me. I actually approve of it, but yeah. So this is a podcast about Marvel Dice Masters. This is our 6th episode, so if you've been listening this long and you did not yet figure out that this was about Dice Masters, there may be something wrong. Go see a doctor. So, guys, we've talked a lot about some of the games that we've played both within Dice Masters and without Dice Masters. I think it's a good idea today to just draw everybody's attention to a couple of Dice Masters resources that are out there. The first one that I want to bring up that I think you guys have used as well is the website Dice Masters DB.
Yeah, I definitely use it. It's fantastic. I do have most of the cards, but this is a really great way that I'm able to look at them all at once, and since I sort them by number, I can look at each of the different variations of the card very easily. That's definitely how I most use it.
Yes, and well, you know, and by the time this episode airs, they ought to be close to having their team builder up. So that'll be a really nice resource to have as well, especially if you're somewhere, you know, maybe you don't have your cards with you, like you went on vacation for some reason, didn't bring every piece of Dice Master stuff you own.
Guys, if you're going on vacation and you're not bringing every piece of Dice Masters, you're doing it wrong.
I'm with you.
I just
want to
put that out there.
I think you're right. But they will have a team builder up there, which will be pretty nice. And I say they will on the night of recording, but it'll be there sometime not that long after this airs. Evan, how about you? Any experience with this site?
I've used it some. I'm also in the boat where I have most of the cars, but there's some rares that I don't yet have and sometimes need to look up for one reason or another. I'm actually expecting to need to do this soon as I'm compiling a big list of everything for nefarious purposes. But which by the time this airs, everyone will know. So
yes,
in any event, yeah, it's useful to pick out things you don't have. I kind of like pouring through my binder full of cards, but sometimes I can't, and that's when I go to the site.
See, what I like is that I don't have mine in a binder. I have them all alphabetically in a deck box. For me, that's just what made it work. I've done the binder thing with CCGs and LCGs before, and I hate, you know, you're transferring from binder to sleeve so darned often that it just kind of got a little tiresome. These, I might not even sleeve them because it's not like the cards are being shuffled or getting handled very roughly at all. So I'm pretty happy with this right now. So this is kind of a nice reference without shuffling through everything. But there is another good site out there that I don't think as many people know about, and this is called clearanddraw.com. Now, a fellow got in touch with me over Board Game Geek just a short while ago to tell me about this. And since he implemented the site, it's gotten better and better. But this site is more of a sortable database for the cards. Now, you can track which cards you own and how many, and which dice you own and how many there. And that'll just store in that 5 megabytes that any website can request to store things on. That'll store that there. So that's not going to go away. Even though you don't have to create an account or, you know, you don't have to do anything like that. The other cool thing, and this is what I really like, this has been a fantastic reference as I've tried to determine the breakdown of some things, but you can sort by various team affiliations. For example, if I want to know who is an X-Man that costs 3, that is a mask, I see that Storm, Gambit, and Beast. Storm, African Priestess, Gambit, Ace, and the Hole, and Beast creature. Of course, if I click Bolt, there aren't any X-Men who cost 3 who are a Bolt. But you can break down cost, rarity, affiliation, type of energy that they give, even the die limits. And you can add all of these things on at once. So you can sort it out however you'd like. I found that to be a very, very nice resource. It has helped me. Well, actually, one of the last episodes that we recorded, I was using that to break down a few of the things with the cost curve and so forth. So great resource, and I definitely recommend both of these. Very different purposes, but both, I think, very great parts of the community.
Yeah, I'll need to check out Clear and Draw a little more. Like I said, I've used Dice Masters DB a couple of times, but I definitely want to take a look at the Clear and Draw now.
Yeah, it's a good resource.
That actually sounds like it may save me some of the Google spreadsheet work I'd need to do.
Yeah, Evan, I thought about you specifically in some of the types of articles that you do. You know, as we were talking about this, I think you'll like this as a resource. It's, it's not anything super pretty, but he's got the nice Dice Masters WizKidsy font for everything, and it all looks very nice. And you can still click on the cards and see what are the abilities. Okay, so let's move on to the mailbag. All right, I love this reader mail stuff. Guys, keep sending it to us, mailbag@thereservepool.com. We love going through this and seeing what people want to talk about. And we welcome not just Dice Masters-related correspondence, but also any kind of gaming. And we have a little bit of that today. Guys, Barry writes to us, and it seems that he is in Germany. And Barry from Germany says, first he says, I love your podcast and all that you're putting on your website. Thanks. His first question is general gaming related. He wants to know if we've played Libertalia. Did we like it if we have? He says he's been having some trouble. He has been trying to get his wife and friends into this game, but they just won't warm to it. He thinks it's a great game in its genre, but no one around him seems to want to play again. So is there a way to get people to warm to a game that you think they are dismissing too easily? So first, I have not played Libertalia. What about you?
I haven't either.
I have.
Tell us about it. I know nothing about it.
I've only played it a couple of times. The general idea is, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a little while, is that you're a bunch of, I don't know if it's pirate commanders or just plain pirates, but you have a bunch of pirate crews. You're basically deciding who's going to pick up what loot for your crew.
Well, if you had to place a genre out of curiosity on Libertalia, what would you say that it is?
It's kind of like resource management, but, or like kind of like worker placement, but not really. It's sort of like, I almost want to say it's a little bit kind of like Seven Wonders-y, but it's hard for me to place, especially since half the time I don't know what the genres are. So
I've got to say, one, I'm curious why they didn't warm to it, but at the same time, it sounds like perhaps, I know this can happen if you come and you're trying to introduce people to the game and you get kind of all in about it and you're trying to teach, that you might want to make sure that when you teach a game, you say, okay, well, you have this card and this card, and it can do this, and looking at everything else, you know, just kind of explain the thinking in a little bit more detail, but don't get too detailed because people will start to zone out. And I think there's like a real sweet spot when it comes to teaching. And not saying you fell into that trap, but it's always something to think about when you're trying to get people excited about it. You want to show them the possibilities and you want to open them up so they're going to think their own thoughts when game two rolls around.
Yeah, you know, and we talk a lot about that, even just when we talked about teaching Dice Masters, you know, how poor the learning game was in the book. I mean, it did okay at teaching the mechanics, but it didn't do a lot of good to helping people understand what the potential is of the game. So it's not just a problem with teaching that can happen sometimes, but it's also just, you know, sometimes, obviously, you love this game, Barry, and obviously Kate's not saying that you did anything wrong in teaching it, but it is also very easy to just, like, the love should just pour over everybody and not understand when it doesn't quite hit. You know, it's hard to know exactly, you know, what happened when you were teaching that, but as far as how to get people to warm to a game that they don't, that they were eh about initially, divide and conquer is one strategy that I have used. If you can get one person to kind of walk through it with you and you can see it, and then they can kind of help be your ambassador to the rest of the group. I mean, obviously they have to be willing to do that, but it's easier to get one person to kind of give in and say, okay, I'll give this another look just for you, man. And then they're like, oh yeah, I really see it now. And then they can kind of say, no guys, look, this was way more fun than we thought because you can do X, Y, or Z. And I've had some pretty good luck with that.
That said, I think that Libertalia actually is better with more people because otherwise it's just a couple of people putting down the cues aren't interesting. And there's a lot less shenanigans with, you know, this card kills the person two ahead and they don't count. And then everyone's like, oh, I got screwed. But maybe they didn't because now they don't have to take that cursed card. And
I think another thing to think about, especially knowing, as Evan said, that he thinks the game is fun with more people. I used to play Risk like it was going out of style when I was in high school. And the way
was going out of style while you were
in high school. Okay, listen you. I had many a long and fun night of that game, mostly because I was a big old history dork. And the way that we made it kind of like really super fun for us was a little bit of role play. You know, we would talk, like we would form alliances, we would strategize, we would like joke that we were like Bismarck and Richelieu, and we were like, hey, see that guy over in Australia? What's up with that? And I think the pirate theme also opens up a little bit of that kind of like Yar pirates sort of thing. And I mean that in a really good way, where if you can kind of get people to buy into the funness of the theme, that can also be a really great hook, especially to get them back. If you're all of age and legal and all those good things, you could, you know, add a little beer, add a little rum,
grog.
Add some grog.
Yeah.
You're German, so probably beer. but you know, just try to bring the theme in a little bit too, especially if it plays okay, a little buzzed, because that can definitely help make people enjoy it a little more. And you can kind of be like, hey, you know, what's up with that pirate over there and what's going on? You know, it depends, because that's another way to get people hooked in. And let me tell you, Risk is not a super fun game. I mean, I love it and I have a great, you know, sentimental attachment to it. But what was fun about it was spending like 16 hours in this game, like just, you know, goofing off and being like, we should attack that guy, we should gang up on that guy. And of course, we've been playing Risk forever, and we were, like I said, a bunch of big dorks. But that's another way to get people into a game, especially if it has a strong theme, like, for example, Letters from Whitechapel. You'll get into the ambiance of the game as well, and I think that can be another way to help people buy into it again.
That's a great idea, and certainly things are way more fun when you can get into the theme of it. And if this game lends itself to that, that might be a way to go. So there was a second part to his question, because this is a Dice Masters podcast, folks. Don't forget that. He's currently living in Germany, as we said, and he's gotten himself a large collection of Marvel Dice Masters cards and dice, but he has a spare full set of commons, some uncommons, and a super rare, which is Mr. Fantastic, and he wants to trade these. He wants to know if there's a good way to go about this in Europe without resorting to selling on eBay. Now, the first thing I have to say, and we mentioned this recently on another episode, those commons are not going to go anywhere unless you are also willing to get rid of the dice. That's important to know. The uncommons, if you have spares of the ones that are the uncommon version of the base set characters, you probably are going to have some luck. Otherwise, it could be iffy. And Mr. Fantastic, unfortunately, is the odd super rare out right now. People, if they want to get like Gobby or Sarina, are trading Mr. Fantastic and cash to try and get that. So that's the first thing. This is not the perfect ideal right now. Maybe it'll get better as the sets get around more. What do you guys want to say about that?
Really, the only thing I can think of is, local gaming shop. Some of them have like little pin boards or like a poster board, and you could probably leave a notice there, which is obviously only local, but you might manage to lucky catch a guy who was just able to get his starter box, and he passes by and he's like, oh, I can get all the commons for, you know, not a ton of money, rather than going into the booster set roulette, if you will, trying to get that full set. You might get some luck there. Other than that, I know you said no eBay, but it's kind of the gold standard for a reason. It's very common. And people go there. It was the first place I went looking when I was like, oh, I got to fill out my collection. I better go look over there. So it was your first thought for a reason. And barring some other resources that, you know, we're American, so, you know, we of course know absolutely nothing, you know, east of the Atlantic and west of the Pacific, because we're uncultured like that. So so I'm not sure, how that's going to work out.
Evan, I feel bad because we kind of took up every single one of the points that could be made here, huh?
Yep. That's why I've been quiet.
Sorry, Evan. You can go first next thing that we do, I promise.
It's okay. I talked a lot when we were talking about Libertalia.
That's fair. All right, so thanks again, Barry, for writing to us. Again, mailbag@thereservepool.com. Talk to us. We want to hear from you. All right, guys, our feature topic today is demolishing the super rares. We are going to tear them down. You know, these super rares are pretty darn good, but they are not quite on the pedestal that some people are placing them upon. They have some powerful abilities, but they are also easily countered. So we're going to look at all four of those super rare cards today: Mr. Fantastic Elastic, Wolverine Knucklehead, Black Widow Sarina, and Green Goblin Gobby. And we're going to kind of talk about, you know, what a lot of the drawbacks are here, because there's been a lot of discussion, and some people are, I've seen it said where some people are lobbying to get the super rare cards banned from organized play at their local game stores. And I think that's just a little bit, I don't want to sound insulting here, but I do think that's a bit short-sighted. And I mean that with no amount of offense at all. I think that there are many, many answers in this game, and I think some of the most dangerous things that we're going to find are going to be largely dependent on the commons, uncommons, and rares, and not so much the super rares. So, all of that said, let's start with Mr. Fantastic Elastic. I will read his ability, and then Evan, I promised you could go first. Mr. Fantastic Elastic is a super rare. He costs 4 and provides mask energy. His ability is, you may spin Mr. Fantastic down 1 level to allow him to block an additional character, or 2 levels to block 2 additional characters. Evan, this one isn't too hard to trash, is it?
No. I mean, he fulfills one very specific purpose. I have one guy, but I need to block several things. He doesn't do anything weird on attack. He doesn't, you know, you don't play him and he shoots your opponent for 1,000,000 damage. He helps you block a bunch of things with only one character. And as such, you can kill him with get rid of him with any assassin card. You can, you know, only attack with one character. You can spin him down. I mean, if he spins down to 1, he can't do his thing. He's just a Mr. Fantastic die. He's worse than his common card. So I think that's basically why he's probably the least liked super rare. He's just not that fantastic, pardon the pun.
Yeah, nobody's talking about Mr. Fantastic, and honestly, it is for a good reason. I do think he might come into his own if we see more cards that allow you to spin up, because we're kind of missing a spin-yourself-up set of characters. There's a lot of spin-your-opponent-down, but not a lot of spin-yourself-up.
Colossus.
Colossus only spins himself up.
Yeah, but he's something like that. Though I do have one question I'm wondering. If you use his ability to spin him down to 1, and then use a focus power to spin him back up, can you keep spinning him down and maybe block 4 guys?
I don't know. It doesn't mention it on the card, so maybe.
Another fact talk.
But, I mean, he's not really going to offer you a lot of options. I mean, he blocks. That's all he does. Once he's spun down, he only does 1 damage to somebody who attacked him. He's useless if you've got throw car or another similar, like, trample effect. Like I said, I only think he's going to start coming into his own when we start to be able to more regularly spin up our own characters. And then he might be a little cooler, but right now he's kind of a dweeb.
Well, the other use that I see for him is if somebody is trying to use the Spider-Man that forces everyone to block Spider-Man, then you could spin Mr. Fantastic down, and now he would, in fact, be able to block an additional character. So, I mean, if a deck, if a squad surrounding that guy, that's Spider-Man Web-Slinger, when Spider-Man assigns to attack, you may pay Fist to force all opposing characters to block him if able. That may give us a bit more flexibility, but I think that's only if squads like that start to become very prevalent in the meta. I think the real problem here is that he's mask energy and he's there to be a blocker. Well, my goodness, we have a lot of mask cards that are fantastic blockers that give us abilities. Beast, Storm, Gambit. I mean, that's just right off the top of my head. 3 right there that give us a lot of utility are fantastic to block because, you know what, we want them knocked out and to recur. So, Mr. Fantastic. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about Wolverine Knucklehead.
Sure. Wolverine is a 6 cost character. He provides Fist energy, and his text reads, when Wolverine attacks alone, he cannot be blocked.
This was the card that everybody was gushing about very, very early on. It was the one-man combo card and all of that, but people have cooled a little bit on him.
I think the big thing that you can say about Knucklehead for me personally is the purchase cost is too dang high. At six, he's a late game purchase, but by the late game, you're not really interested in having a character attack alone. In a lot of ways, I've found almost all of my games have won by, grinding down the opponent's defenses a little bit, or them taking an ill-timed attack, and then you go kind of all in, and then like boom, 15 damage. And there's the game. I mean, obviously, it takes a long time to get to that position, but that has been how a large number of my games have resolved.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, I think he's sort of interesting going with Angel Soaring, but he's sort of like an end cap to that idea of, haha, I have unblockable men. But at the same time, then you have to just attack with him, and your angels are going to sit there sad and in the corner, and they can't do anything because Mr. Big Wolverine has to go through alone. And I think he's just, it's nice to say, okay, yeah, I can do 8 damage in one turn, and there's nothing my opponent can do about it aside from, rolling a storm at some point or whatever, or some other, storm wouldn't help, but some other shenanigans.
Well, yeah, you're right, because he costs 6, as Katie said. He costs 6, so, I mean, he's a late-game field. How many of him are you really going to be able to buy and then actually use? And as soon as you do get him out and use him successfully, well, he's off to use, and you have to hope that you get him again. Now, if you're running, perhaps, Brimstone Biker, and as soon as he goes into use, then you can pull him out and field him and throw Wolverine back in your prep area, then, well, fine, but that's awfully situational, and you can't rely on fiddly things late game. You need to know that your combos are there.
Yeah, I agree. I also have to say Wolverine is fairly vulnerable to both the Distraction Global and Mr. Fantastic / Phoenix's Global that forces an attack. If your opponent puts Knucklehead down and you have a Global of Mr. Fantastic or Phoenix, you can pull someone else out, and you can say, well, okay, that's okay, and your beast attacks this turn, and you keep your opponent from being able to even attack alone. Thus,
right, with the caveat that you have to do that at the end of your main step.
Yes.
So you don't know whether or not they're going to choose to have Wolverine attack at that point.
It's true, but honestly, it's a great way to protect yourself from it, is say, also this turn beast attacks, or also this turn some other, smaller character attacks. It's a pretty surefire defense against Wolverine character must attack. And then again, like I said, Distraction. If he does attack, you say, okay, no, he doesn't. And he goes back to the field. And you've got this character who's sitting there, and you can't use him to best effect because there are several cards that directly muck with his ability.
Yeah, it's true. There is a bit of an overvaluing in this game over, like, the ability to do a fair amount of damage, like not an insignificant amount of damage, a fair amount of damage sometime in the mid game, but it takes your opponent from, I don't know, like 15 to 8 or 7. And that's really, really good. But what does it leave you with? And if it leaves you with not enough, then it's actually not worth doing that damage right now. And if your goal is to get this Wolverine really, really, really fast, and you're going to do that, and you're going to rely on that to bust out, bust down the doors and get some damage, well, that's not quite enough to end the game. And what do you have set up afterwards? Especially if you're centering things around him, that means you're not necessarily looking to attack with other characters. I think there are more drawbacks to using him than there are advantages. And I think he was, again, I think he was overvalued at first because people looked at the ability to quick loss of life versus when is that quick loss of life actually going to matter the most.
Yeah, I personally like formerly Weapon 10 as far as Wolverines go a lot more. You can buy him for 4. He buffs up real nice if you do have him attack alone. But he's a 4 cost, and for me that's so much better.
Yeah, in fact, you used him to great effect against me. It was a very close game until I prevailed right at the end. What did you combo formerly Weapon 10 with? I'm trying to remember.
It was Distraction, the actual action, not the global. I actually used Distraction, forcing Dave to not allow 2 of his characters to block, because weapon 10 is blockable. He only had two characters out. I used distraction. I attacked with weapon 10. He gets +4/+4. And I did, 9 or 10 damage to him all in one go just because of that +4 that he gets when he attacks alone. And he was completely unable to block.
That was it.
And it was... It was primo. I was relatively limited in my card options for various reasons, and that was kind of the one combo I had in mind, and I did almost prevail.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely, if you want to take the risk, say, okay, I'll buy two Wolverines my first two turns, and if I get one of them on my next turn and he rolls 3-face, that's 12 health off of my opponent if he hasn't managed to get up any sidekicks or anything.
Very true.
Yeah, big risk, though. Absolutely right. Okay, so let's move on to the two super rares who are very, very much dominating the... forgive me if I'm using this word improperly, but dominating the zeitgeist of Dice Masters at the moment. Let's talk about Sarina.
Black Widow Sarina is a two-fist Avengers character with the ability, when Black Widow attacks, she deals 2 damage to your opponent. Your opponent can prevent this by spinning one of his or her characters down 1 level.
Okay, so let's agree on one thing here. She's very good, right?
Serena's awesome.
Yeah, yes. She rocks. But let's agree on something else. There are many, many wonderful ways to deal with her.
Got to agree.
My favorite, and we've talked about this a couple of different times, is, well, either... Beast Mutate 666 or Beast Genetic Expert. 666 is the dice one. Genetic Expert is the direct damage one. And that is because Beast is a when blocking trigger and for his abilities. And his burst is on level 1. You want to spin him down, so she's not going to do her damage. If you're using Beast 666, then you block with him and you get to draw some dice. If you're using Genetic Expert, you block with him and you do some damage and a little bit extra because of the burst phase. That is a fantastic way to deal with her. Is she somebody that you still have to worry about? Yeah, definitely you do. But I think there are going to be very, very, very few people who do not have, especially B666 here. Of the options, 666 is the more versatile one. He's great in just about every circumstance. Genetic Expert is not great in as many circumstances because he takes away some of your churn. But he's a great card against Sarina. He's the best Sarina counter. But he might not be quite as good in other situations. Still a very good card, though. But either way, Beast helps you deal with her very, very well. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. You block with him, he may get KO'd, but you get to roll him again. And if you don't get his character face, you get some masks. And he's so cheap that you're going to get more of them out. You're going to buy more of them. They're going to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Evan and I were playing, and I had a Sarina out, and I was trying to kind of sandpaper him to death, and he just kept fielding stuff. You know, it didn't matter. Oh, I fielded a level 3 beast. I attack with 2 Sarinas. Sucks to be you, because I block it with 1 beast, and I block it with this other thing, and now I have a bunch of cards, and now I have a bunch of dice, and next turn I get to roll these, and then I get to buy huge things. I mean, really, the thing about Sarina is, if your opponent has 666, you're giving him or her a ton of dice. And giving your opponent a ton of dice is a surefire way for your opponent to get to buy a big character, get to field a larger character with ease. And
giving your opponent tempo. That's yes. What you're doing. You're saying, have some tempo. Have more tempo than me.
Yep. And if you don't bring her with a lot of your own churn, and a lot of people will neglect their own churn, thinking, oh, I'll just buy, 4 Black Widows for my first turn, you've set yourself up to not be able to buy anything else. And that is bad.
Yeah, we're just in general, you have these Black Widows, and then, well, I want to keep the pressure on and keep forcing my opponent to roll down all those beasts and whatnot he's acquiring so that I can, maybe actually do some damage to him. But then you're spending energy and time fielding these Black Widows, and you're not getting enough energy to roll what you want and buy other things, and you get sort of locked in this Black Widow mindset. Your opponent's just saying, haha, I have a million dice and buying, you know, five Doctor Stranges, and that'll just be bad.
Yep, that's all she wrote. I mean, if you don't have the pressure on right in that third turn, if you have Black Widows and you're not winning, like, on turn three, you may very well not win. She's a very quick, cheap field, but the game can go against you really quickly if you don't lock it down very, very quickly.
Exactly. There are many drawbacks to her. You have to take care of the turn, as you said there. Now, let's agree again. If your opponent is not prepared for Black Widow, she will destroy you. Katie, you and I were playing a blind draft recently, and I happened to roll it, or I happened to luck into getting Black Widow on my team, and you didn't have a good option on your team to really prepare for her, and we were both stuck with some high cost characters. But the difference really was I had Black Widow and you didn't. And that was the game. I mean, it wasn't your fault. There was nothing you could do.
I was also robbed of course, Beast. Again, Beast is a great counter for Tsarina. That was actually the same game as I got formerly Weapon 10, because I saw that Dave had picked up a Black Widow, that he was going to bring Tsarina, that I didn't have a good counter for her. And I said, okay, I'm going to try to blitz Dave harder than Dave blitzes me. And I did very closely almost make it. It really came down to who blitzed faster. And in that particular circumstance, Black Widow was a little faster than Weapon 10.
Yeah, because you have to have that early game answer. Now, let me say again about, I cannot emphasize enough how much Beast Genetic Expert will just screw with a person's head who's using Black Widow. And I can say this as somebody who has been on both sides of it. If the other person has Genetic Expert out, I am scared to death to attack with Black Widow, because they are going to spin down Genetic Expert and they are going to do damage to me. It's going to come out as a wash. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. She's scary. And I was scared to be aggressive early game when I played against her, because, you know, I knew it was going to happen. Excuse me, I played against him. I played against Genetic Expert. I knew it was going to happen. But it gains life. When Beast is knocked out while blocking, you gain a life, and your opponent takes two damage. It's down to level one. I'm going to take damage.
Yep, only on the burst side. But that was you and me. And I only had one or two of them out. And Dave was quaking in his boots. He was like, oh, I can't attack with Tsarina. He stopped buying them. I had one or two of these out, and he's like, I'm not going to buy them. I'm not going to attack with her. I can't use her. She's only good for energy right now. And I really got into his head, with that particular combination. I was like, yeah, I'll bring Genetic Expert. What you going to do?
And I've seen it on the other side of the table too. It affects people. And if you really think that, like, you're going to go to, so you're hybrid constructed and everybody you think is going to have Tsarina, then throw Genetic Expert in your deck. Like, if everybody's talking about bringing her, throw Genetic Expert in your deck and watch your opponents have no idea what to do, because you're going to gain life back. you're not only is she not going to do the two damage because you're going to spin him down, you're going to gain life back. And if you spun him down to level one, you're going to do two damage to your opponent. They're never going to attack with Tsarina again.
Big head game. Big head game. And, we do have some other cheap churn options. We, of course, on the show love Norman Osborn, Green Goblin.
It's Nog, Nog, Nog.
Nog, Nog, Nog. Evan, do you want to write a love letter to Nog?
I have already done so.
Yes, he did. You can find that on the blog. It's a Nog blog. I'm sorry. All right, so let's move on then, and let's discuss our old buddy, our old pal, Green Goblin. And this is Gobby. Gobby is notorious.
Green Goblin Gobby is a 3-bolt cost. He's affiliated with the villain faction. And his card ability is, when fielded, Green Goblin deals 1 damage to your opponent for each sidekick in the field. Count your sidekicks only.
Okay. Again, let's agree. He's very good.
Very good, yes.
Yep, absolutely. There are, of course, problems with him. The first one is he is heavily dependent on sidekicks.
And there's a few issues with that. Well, firstly, It means if you want to take advantage of his ability, you got to be rolling sidekicks, and you're probably going to want to be rolling sidekicks early before your opponent has ways to deal with them. That means your first couple of turns are probably going to be try for a sidekick and buy a gobby. Try for a sidekick and buy a gobby. So you've got two sidekicks out, and you've got six sidekicks and two gobbies in your deck. Probably means you're getting a gobby and three sidekick dice for your next turn. And the idea is, you know, keep putting out those sidekicks. But as you're doing this, you're shrinking the amount of energy you have to roll. And, you know, you're very rapidly getting to the point where you only really have two energy or something to buy a turn. It's maybe okay if you, you know, start buying Black Widows or something, or Beasts. But that dilutes your pool, makes it harder for you to get sidekicks out if your opponent starts killing them. And you went into this, you wind up painting yourself into that corner like you did with Tsarina, where, you know, I can't buy anything, but I just have my gobbies to rely on. And if your opponent gets a coherent strategy, if you haven't managed to get some other stuff going, either by not rolling gobbies or buying other characters and using them for energy, you're going to find yourself facing down whatever big stuff your opponent comes up with. And that'll be all she wrote.
And that's just it. The other thing is that his ability is a when-fielded trigger. And my favorite when-fielded trigger characters are ones like Gambit or Storm, where the power level of the die, you know, not a huge attack, but not a huge defense either. The power level of the die there means that you're going to be able to get them knocked out and cycle them right back through. They're going to knock out, go to prep, you roll them again, bam, when-fielded again in all likelihood. So Gobby has a when fielded ability, but he is not so easy to keep on the field, especially on his third face. Now, he does have a low total fielding cost. It's just two, but he's 2-2, 3-3, and then 5-5. 2-2 is not going to... Storm is not going to knock him out there. 3-3 Beast is not going to knock him out there on his lower levels. 5-5, nobody's going to knock him out. You keep him on the field, and he's a one-shot. And maybe you get another Gobby out, but then, like you said, Evan, you focus so much on Gobbies, and then you have sidekicks out if you're going to do any damage with him, that you're really hamstringing yourself as far as anything else that you're able to purchase. It's just somewhere you have to use those sidekick dice for energy early on. And if you're fielding them a lot in prep for Gobby to happen, then they're not going to work. And oh, speaking of Storm, how about a fantastic Gobby counter is Storm Windrider. I suppose you could also use African Priestess, but I like Windrider more. This is just devastating on sidekicks. With Windrider, you reroll Windrider. I kind of got Windrider there. I sound like the guy from Princess Bride, right? Marriage!
Marriage is what brings us together.
Anyway, when fielded, re-roll up to two opposing characters. Each die that does not roll a character goes to your opponent's used pile, and Storm deals two damage to your opponent for each die moved. You have a very, 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 very good chance that if you're choosing to re-roll sidekicks, they are going to go to use, and they're going to do four damage. And now they're not there to do the damage to you that Gobby was going to do either. So if you keep Gobby on the field and you destroy your opponent's sidekicks, very easy to do, then you have it figured out.
Yeah, I definitely agree that Windrider, and I just love Windrider, just like 666 is a strong counter to Tsarina. Storm Windrider is a really good include anyway. I mean, I bring her a lot anyway. She's very good. You've got a pretty good chance to knock out or to send to the used pile at least one of your opponent's characters each time you field her. And you do damage to your opponent as well. That's awesome. She's a little expensive at five, but honestly, you can be grabbing five cost characters easily on turn four-ish, and with a little bit of less effort by turn like five or six. So I don't consider her some like really late game character. Five cost is more than four, but it's not seven. She doesn't cost seven. She costs five.
Yeah, and I mixed up her stats. She would knock Gabi. I thought she was 1-2 on level 1. She's 2-1, and that was my mistake. But yeah, she's good anywhere. She's not just good against Gabi. She's good against a lot of things. Just like B666 is good in just about anything. And Genetic Expert, too, to a lesser extent. I mean, the biggest knock against Genetic Expert, as we've said, is that he's not 666. I mean, that's it. That's the only thing that would make him better. He doesn't have that churn. But Storm's good anyway. So these aren't characters that you bring just because you think you're going to see Gabi, you think you're going to see Sarena. These are characters that you bring because you think you want to win. I have both Beast Mutate 666 and Storm Windrider in that control deck that I was talking about that I've done pretty well with so far. So, I mean, these are characters that are good not just against Gabi or Sarena, but on an island.
Yeah, and realistically, I mean, it doesn't have to be Windrider. If you prefer Goddess of the Plane, that'll knock out all your opponent's sidekicks most of the time. So, you know, yes, he will get to roll them next turn, but it's not like a character where they have a 75% chance of getting that character to reroll as a character. They have a much lower chance of seeing sidekicks come back. So you're defanging them that well, pretty well that way. You know, there are plenty of other options that are, you know, maybe a little more off the beaten track for dealing with Gabi. Reed Richards' rival Dr. Doom, that'll do it just as well.
Yep.
That's true. It'll knock out the sidekicks right there. Now, the only thing I don't like about Goddess is that if you are using her and everything goes to the prep area, then you're basically solving Gabi's energy drawback for your opponent. You're saying, oh, remember how, like, you didn't get to buy enough? Well, happy birthday.
Yeah, I do.
But
have
otherwise,
to
you're right.
Yep. Evan and I actually, pretty early on, we played Gabi versus Nog, and just to kind of get our own personal feels for the two characters. And admittedly, Evan had a deck that really slaughtered sidekicks. He had taken Dr. Doom. But at the end of the day, Gabi is the antithesis of early churn. He is the exact opposite. He is anti-churn. And yeah. He's going to suck you dry of energy. And it even with Beast, if you're like by turn three, you get to start picking up some beasts. It's not enough. And you're going to set yourself behind the energy curve eight ball. You're going to lock yourself into really cheap characters while your opponent is starting to fairly easily purchase those fives, purchase those sixes. If they've got a seven, they're working their way up to that fairly easily, all while putting yourself at the mercy of particularly low probability sidekick fielding. So all of that is a little shaky.
That's pretty much it. I mean, as you say, Gabi, and it really, Sarena too, they are both anti-churn, because if you're buying them early and taking advantage of their low field cost, then there's other things that you're not buying. You know, people are only looking at the cost that is associated to purchase the card, or purchase the die, rather, and then to field the die. But they are not paying attention to the cost in game tempo. And if you are not... if you're not paying attention to tempo, then you're going to have a very difficult time winning these games, especially if you're playing against people who are. It's an incredibly important part. Tempo is very closely related to churn. One helps the other. But if you're not paying attention to tempo, then you're going to have a difficult time winning, because your opponent is probably paying attention to tempo. Whoa, wait a minute. This is Future Dave cutting in here. Jason, I'm about to call you Justin, and I'm really sorry about that. I don't know what we were thinking. Okay, let's go back. If you want to see tempo versus not tempo and see how damaging it is and how important it is to pay attention, watch one of the most recent Married with Clixes, where Justin is using a team that is basically entirely churn. It's all dice drawing, and Amber is using a team of only villains. And I, you know, I get what they're going for. They're trying to try different combinations and everything like that. I don't think Amber thinks that is the best team in the whole wide world or anything like that. But you can see what Justin's dice drawing team was able to do against Amber. And honestly, the game maybe even went on just a little bit longer than it could have. I think Justin had the opportunity to wrap it up a little bit sooner. And again, that's nothing on those two. That's more about the fact that this is how important it is. If you're not paying attention to tempo, you're not going to win.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, of course, I do think Amber was a little behind the eight ball going for the thematic villains since they are so costly on the whole. And I believe she only had access to the, I forgot the name of Green Goblin's common, but...
Goblin Lord.
Goblin Lord is definitely the worst of the Green Goblin children. But that's what you see as well. You can't rely on all these big cost characters like, oh, I'll get out these big cost characters. Well, you won't if you don't have Beast. You won't if you don't have Gambit. You won't if you don't have Nova. And again, all goes back to churn. You've got to be thinking about it constantly. You've got to know how you're going to get more dice. And again, that's the big problem with both Black Widow and Gobby is if you come in with your... lots of energy options. They might do some early damage to you while you get yourself set up, but then it stops.
Yes, keep calm, stick to your plan. You're going to prevail as long as you have set up your team correctly early on. They are intimidating, but they are not the be-all end-all. They sacrifice tempo for the opponent. And here's the other side of that I meant to mention. If your opponent is trying to pay attention to tempo while still using Sarina and Gobby, if they are trying to get those beasts out early and so forth and so on, then now Sarina and Gobby have become more mid-game bias rather than early-game bias just by the necessity of how they're buying and drawing cards, and they're not going to be as effective by then either. So, you know, one way or the other... there's a very narrow window where they can be effective, and a lot of their effectiveness relies on the opponent being unprepared.
Truth.
Though I do think that I think that's why actually Sarina works a little better than Gobby. Sarina, I do think you can buy, you know, two of them one turn, and then buy other stuff your next of your two starters turns.
Truth.
And then you can start chipping away with Sarinas, maybe not as heavy as you would if you bought before, but you can start using them to plink away at your opponent because they are pretty relentless like that. And then you can still keep on doing the other things you need to do to get the rest of your deck going. Whereas Gobby's really, if you're bringing Gobby, you're playing Gobby. And that's, unless you make a really concerted effort, that's pretty much all you're doing.
Yeah, it's true. I like Sarina as a complimentary piece. I think she's good. Honestly, I'd like maybe as a part of an Avengers team plus Beast, where like somewhere in the first two turns, I'm buying a combination of Beast, Nick Fury, the one who lets you field Avengers for free, and Sarina. And that's all. Those are some great two-cost characters to buy right away. And she's in complement, and now... You know, she can help really throw a wrench into the works later in the game when the opponent isn't necessarily sure who to block and you found some other ways to control things with them. But yeah, so hopefully you have some more ideas as far as dealing with those super rares. They're out there. They're intimidating. But please keep in mind what your opponent is sacrificing if they are going with a heavy strategy based on Sarina, based on Gobby, and of course, to an even greater extent with the... with Knucklehead, and I can't even imagine at this point a strategy that is based on Mr. Fantastic. I mean, he's defensive. There's nothing.
They're hoping that you'll fall over laughing from having a deck focused on Mr. Fantastic and forfeit the match.
I think that's true.
They'll look at Mr. Fantastic sitting there on your sideboard. They'll look at you. They'll look at Mr. Fantastic. They'll look at you. And they'll figure that you are the smartest son of a gun that ever sat down at the table because they have no idea what's coming with this guy.
I'm putting you in reserve pool jail for calling it sideboard again.
Sorry. What's my punishment, Dave?
I don't have one yet, but we'll let you know. Guys, when she says sideboard, she's looking at the she's talking about the characters that you have available for
purchase.
I'm
sorry. I mean, your
Not
party,
your sideboard like your, in Magic.
Your party of characters.
Your squad.
Your squad
is my preferred term.
Your squad. Your squad of eight.
Your deck, maybe, even.
All right. Well, instead of making fun of Katie, let's make fun of the rules a little bit. Are the rules getting you down? Us too. That's why it's time for Fact Talk. All right, we are happy to once again have Fact Talk because we are the happiest when we get to complain about something just like most people. Okay, today we are here to talk about Hawkeye Robin Hood. Evan, take it away.
Okay. Hawkeye Robin Hood's ability is, when assigning damage in attack step, Hawkeye assigns and resolves his damage before opposing characters. If you're familiar with Magic, this is the fabled First Strike. The question we have about a relatively straightforward ability is, what happens when you have a character like Hulk, like the various forms of Hulk, or like Nova Buckethead, who do something with damage when they take it? You know, specifically, if you have a Hawkeye being blocked by a Hulk, okay, Hawkeye does his damage to Hulk, and Hulk explodes at people if it's Green Goliath Hulk. Okay, so everything's taken 2 damage now. What happens if you have some guy who's only got 2 defense? Does he die then? Does he get to do damage to other things? The rules aren't really clear on this. They mention that there is a damage-dealing step where all damage clears, but this is sort of happening in a special damage-dealing step before then. So, does it have to wait till the real damage-clearing step? Or does it go right then and there?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the problem here is I could literally argue this either way. I could argue myself into either position quite easily. Hulk is taking damage before everybody else is assigning damage. He should probably do that right then. On the other hand, he's in the attack step, and attack step damage takes place in a very specific time, which is when all damage is resolving together. I honestly could take it either way. And honestly, if a judge had to rule on that during a tournament, I would literally have not a leg to stand on, no matter which way he or she ruled.
I'm trying to look at this with the rules, and I'm here on page 8 of the rule book in the assigned damage step, and it says that once all damage has been assigned, knock out each character that took damage greater than or equal to its defense. We know that. When a character is knocked out, move it to its player's prep area. We know that. Then it says if game effects are generated by a character being knocked out or by taking damage, the attacking player resolves all effects first, then the defender. But the problem here is that it's not clear how much of a special extra part of the attack step that Hawkeye is getting here, since he's assigning and resolving the damage first. Now, I mean, obviously, since he does it, if he would knock out a character, then that character wouldn't do damage to him. If it did, then the card would be useless. If that's what they intend, then there's no point to the card. So, obviously, that must be able to force that character into being knocked out. However, in the rulebook, it says that you don't knock out characters until all damage has been assigned, in the same paragraph where it's talking about game effects being generated by taking damage. So, for Hawkeye to be effective, it's logical to say that his first strike means that he knocks out a character, potentially, and then that character can do no damage to him.
I honestly see no reason for the card if that's not how it affects the game.
Exactly. But if he triggers an effect, but then, since that's in the same paragraph describing when triggers like that go off, then it would seem to indicate that the trigger happens, because that paragraph is not supposed to take place until all damage has been assigned. But in this case, clearly Hawkeye assigns and resolves, so the character gets knocked out, if it's lower defense than him. So what happens if it's a Hawkeye against, say, a Hulk? Now, maybe that means that this is strictly a blocking card. But if that's the case, I don't know if I want to use him.
because I'd rather get something like you know, his common form and have an effective assassin.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I could see it go either way, and I really do think the card is meant to have first strike, as Evan called it from the Magic era, where if Hawkeye hits someone and they're knocked out, they don't do any damage to him, because again, the card is pointless if that's not the case. But again, the damage effects or the effects from being knocked out or from taking damage don't happen until all damage is cleared, and not all damage has yet cleared. When we're just talking about Hawkeye's damage, there is still more damage to be cleared. So I haven't the foggiest.
Right, and yet knocking out is not supposed to happen until all damage is cleared either. And still it would for Hawkeye, assuming his first strike works the way that we assume that it does. So of course, guys, the problem here is that if it is if he is faced off with a Hulk at some point, then Hulk now his ability triggers, and he maybe it's Green Goliath, and he deals 2 damage to each opposing character. Well, that means that you might have some characters that get knocked out before they can deal their damage as blockers. The opposing people are still, you know, everybody's still blocked and other things aren't happening, but damage might not be dealt at all. So we really could use some clarity on here. Until then, if you are bringing Hawkeye Robin Hood and you're playing an organized play and there is somebody who's actually a judge there, I don't think you certainly don't attack with him. I don't think you use him in any situation and where you don't have control over who he's assigned to, who he's engaged with. And if you have to be so limited with him, I say don't bring him at all.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I prefer the common a lot more. Hawkeye Longbow costs a little more, way better, awesome assassin. Personally, if I were taking a Robin Hood to organize play, I would ask for clarity beforehand. You don't want him to be one of your 4 that you bring and have him be wasted when the judge rules out of your favor, away from your favor.
I was actually going to say that I think that looking at the FAQ and how it says it, I think the question isn't so much, you know, when does this damage clear? The question's really with Robin Hood, does any effects triggered by the damage he deal resolve them?
Was Robin Hood a part of the FAQ?
No.
Oh, okay.
But there is the response, if a character with a game effect that is triggered by taking damage is knocked out due to damage dealt in combat, does their game effect occur? Yes.
Yes.
So the question isn't so much, you know, does Green Goliath explode? It's when does the explosion hurt people?
Yeah, I mean, it's still not clear. Literally no answer to this, as far as I can tell.
And you could make an argument either way,
yep,
because it's, you know, this magical pre-damage phase.
And it would be,
or is it just say, okay,
argument,
it deals damage with everything else and it gets pushed later and everything punches as normal and Hawkeye dies anyway because sucks to be you, Clint.
Aw, arrows.
Oh, man. That's okay. Give me Green Arrow in a fight any day. All right. So with that, we come to the end of another episode of The Reserve Pool. What do you think about that FAQ issue? Please let us know. There's plenty of places you can do that, whether it's the comments on Blogger, whether it's our Board Game Geek Guild, where you can vote on the character overviews that we do, whether it's on our mailbag@thereservepool.com, or Twitter, @TheReservePool. We also would love to see you leave your reviews on iTunes. We gave a shout out recently to the 3 5 stars that we had at the time of that recording, and that's where we sit right now. We'd also love to see you continue to give us love on Board Game Links. We are continuing to climb slowly but surely up the rankings there, and guys, I just think this is so awesome for what's a very niche podcast, a very niche site right now, for us to be up there right around some other, you know, shows that are pretty popular and more potpourri in their own right. So thank you guys so much for all the support. I know I speak for Katie and Evan on that too, right, guys?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We love it. You guys are just letting us have so much fun. And bottom of my heart, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. All right. So thank you so much for spending some time with us, letting us spend some time with you. Have a great one. And we'll see you all in 1 week.
See you next time, guys.
See you next time.
Black Wino Sarina is a two-fist character.
Did you say Black Wino?
Wino. I'll try that again just in case I did say Black Wino.
Black Guido.
It was either Black Wino or Black Guido.